come to order. Members in attendance on the 11th day of May. You want to hold on the conversation, please? Representative Larson, Furness, M.M. Miller, Cowdery, Schultz, and Abood. And away we go. See, Mr. Berry, I hope you're feeling better today.
I feel definitely better. Still lousy, but definitely
looks like you're just, but you're better.
Chairman, got anything for
you? Sir?
Are we not going to consider those two election bills that are up today?
Yeah, I was trying to get there.
Oh, okay. I didn't see on the packet, sir.
See, I wonder how long they'll take. Yeah, I wanted those, Yeah, let us take up, 257. I'm sorry. House Bill 362, the ethics bill again. Mr. Barrier, could you come over, please, and identify yourself for the record and we'll commence?
He did say 257.
No. 362.
I'm Bill Barrier, Director of Legal Services for the Legislature, or for Legislative Affairs, I think.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do you see substantial differences? Of course, there's substantial differences between the Senate bill and the House bill. And I think they're quite substantial.
Yes, they are, Mr. Chairman.
And, does anyone have any questions to Mr. Berger regarding this? Go ahead, Mr. Cowdery.
No, I thought maybe we could recall where we was at the last meeting and just go.
You were down through part of the bill there, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
If you would continue, sir.
I'm trying to recall where we left off.
Okay, we left
on 362.
Someplace on page 5,
I think. I believe it was. We've gotten through contracts.
I thought we'd gotten through contracts and loans.
Right.
I don't remember. We're somewhere either on confidential information or interest between public officials. I believe interest between public officials.
Yes. I'd like to have the other packets, too, because I'll be taking those other two bills up today. No, I didn't. I didn't cancel them.
I called the division president.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Furness.
Mr. Chairman, on page 5, starting on line 15, is section 2460.070, interest between public officials. This deals with the formation or maintenance of a close economic association between the person to whom this chapter applies and what is broken down basically into two classes of public officials. One, the persons in A, 1, 2, and 3 are a supervisor who has direct authority, other legislators, or a public official in another branch who is required to file a disclosure statement, in other words, a major public official. If there is a close economic association there, there has to be a disclosure to the Ethics Commission. B takes the prohibitory approach rather than the disclosure approach, and if there's a close economic association involving a substantial financial matter with a lobbyist, this is prohibited, unless the lobbyist is a member of your immediate family, of the immediate family of the person.
The Miller Amendment.
The Miller Amendment.
That one has a lobbyist. But if one of us had, it would have to be me, because she was a lobbyist before I was a legislator.
Section 2460.080, which starts on page 2, line 2, page 6, is the gift section. Essentially, what it provides is that a person may not solicit a gift in any amount, period, a person to whom this chapter applies.
Mr. Barrier.
Yes.
According to the Senate version, 257, on line 12, under the 080 gifts, He's got a very short sentence. The person to whom this chap replies may not solicit a gift or accept or receive direct or indirect gift, whether in the form of money, service, a loan, travel, entertainment, hospitality, or other form, under circumstances in which it may be reasonable for the gift was intended as a reward for an official action by the person. Doesn't that pretty well clarify what gifts mean rather than everything else that goes down through the House Bill 362 on page 6?
Mr. Chairman, what the Senate did was, and if you read it, I think it makes more sense. They moved Section B, which is lines 10 through 19, back over into the conflict of interest section, 080, providing that it is not a conflict of interest to do these things. And basically, that's what it says here, except it really fits better under a conflict of interest. In the Senate bill, it's on page 3, lines 8 through 19. The Senate incidentally made a couple changes in B. I'll get to changes in A later, because they made some significant changes in A. In B, the Senate took away gifts from a person's immediate family. Since immediate family is normally the nuclear family, and people get gifts from cousins, nephews, nieces, and so forth. And they added, on line 17 and 18 on 257 Judiciary, food and foodstuffs indigenous to the state that are generally shared as a cultural or social norm. I gather that as you visit the villages, there's a great tendency to give you food. I can't speak to that, but some of the legislators that represent a rural area did. Then on A, there is a substantial difference.
Is this why Mr. Vasquez has 6 meals a day?
The records show that Mr. Vasquez joined us. You have any comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. As a matter of fact, Mr. Barrier is correct. Mr. Miller is wrong. I don't get 6 meals, I get 9 full meals a day.
Value over $100.
Probably. That doesn't include all the coffee and tea breaks throughout the whole day.
In Section A, the primary difference between the Senate version and the House version is that the Senate version absolutely took out the dollar amount as a gift, period. And they took out the gift as intended to influence the person in the performance of the duties of the person, and left if the gift was intended as a reward for official action by the person. The Senate also added a gift of travel and hospitality received by a member of the legislature and obtaining information on matters of legislative concern is not prohibited by this section. There was a good deal of testimony that in the larger rural districts, sometimes this is the only way to travel, that they'll have a dedication or something in a remote area, but there's no practical way to get to it, but you go, quote, back in somebody's plane that's been chartered, and that there's kind of a prohibitively expensive thing. Then on C.
Mr. Chairman, before we leave B, I noticed we were discussing the other day where it says just ground or water transportation. That would imply, of course, that any air transportation would be a gift. And is that our intent?
Mr. Larson, I don't know what. I guess you're going to be a crook for $100, but you're not going to be for $99.95. So I just don't know what that has in relation to it. But.
One problem, if I may be allowed just a little leeway, that I always had with this, and I think maybe I haven't seen it as much here as in the legislature as I have in the past, and I'm sure there are occasions, where you get foreign visitors, whether it be the Taiwanese, or whether it be the Koreans, or whether it be the Japanese, that oftentimes they are a bearer of gifts, because that is their historical and their cultural customs. And I guess what we are doing here in some ways is creating a piece of legislation that will not promote good relations with those people, but will do just the opposite. It will be an insult in some ways for some people. And I do have some problem with that.
If I could comment, this is the difference. This intended to influence language taken out. This is a difference between the two versions. Should I go ahead and talk about the difference between the versions of the bills because you mentioned it here? The Senate took out this intended to influence, and the kind of situation Representative Larson is talking about may be intended to influence, but it's not a reward for your official action. So the Incidentally, they kept using, there seems to have been a gift, a visit from a Chinese delegation recently, who apparently do give gifts. Under the Senate version, that would be permissible. Under the House, under the original version as it came out of legislative reform, it would not be.
Okay. Do you want to continue, sir?
Mr. Chairman, under C, the Commission may establish policies that limit the extent to which you may take these gifts, or that requires public officials to turn over the benefits to the agency. The Senate Judiciary changed that to the committee may, with approval of the legislature, establish additional policies that limit the extent to which persons whom this chapter applies may accept the benefits set out in E of this section. In other words, the two changes there are they required legislative approval for these policies, and they knocked out or requires that you turn the benefits over the received over the agency.
What would happen to the agency if they did turn over stuff to them? What would the agency do with it?
Sell it.
It would go back to general fund. Though I don't know what you would do with an amiga ticket.
Mr. Vasquez.
Thank you. Mr. Berry, you just quoted the change that the Senate Judiciary put in there. I had a question about that. Would you repeat that, please?
The language on
C.
C? Yes, in the Senate Judiciary version, that becomes F under conflict of interest. The committee may, with approval of the legislature, establish additional policies.
What portion of the legislature is it by majority? Approval of a majority of the members?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
No voting requirement is set out, so I would assume it would have to be by both houses, but where you don't have a voting requirement, it could be adopted by a majority of those present if those present constituted a quorum.
This is done by resolution?
It could be done by resolution, or as it was set out, it could be done by motion in each house. A resolution would be the obvious vehicle.
Yeah. Why couldn't they, getting back to the other one again, if he was turned over to them, why couldn't they turn it back to the contributor or the... rather than keep it in the agency? Why should they give it back? Because it's conflict of interest to them, too.
Mr. Chairman, when it say turn over the benefits to the agency, that means to the state. In other words, you would turn it over, but the agency wouldn't keep it. It would go back to the state as a whole. And I think there's probably... it's hard for the state itself to have a conflict of interest. I say it'd go back to General Treasury.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If I may. Is this a conflict? Then all the members of the Resource Committee received a letter, to my knowledge anyway, and it come from the Senate side, asking that to, and I don't know whether it's out of Sitka, I think, the Snishitisam, or whatever it is.
Snishitisam.
Okay, anyway, to go over there and look at that project, and the Resource Committee would pay for the transportation down to Sitka. From there on, the people that operate that mine, whatever it is, the borax mine, where they're talking about putting this, it's borax. They take them over to see that. Now that whole thing, by the time it was said and done, if all the Resource Committee would go, I would imagine if you broke that down into costs, that would be considerably more than $100. By the time you're flown over and looked at the place, but at the same time, it is in the interest of legislation and understanding and knowing a little bit more about what you're actually doing. You know, would that fall under a conflict of interest?
Not among ourselves, I don't think. Well, yes, it would.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Berry.
Let me glance again. The gift section.
Through the chair, yes. Representative Vasquez, you're familiar with the letter that I'm talking about, Representative Larson.
I don't think we got those.
So you come from Senator Fisher.
Oh, yeah, we did get that,
did we?
Yeah.
Mr. Baer.
Mr. Chairman. There is a question that seemed to have been hotly debated at times as to whether, and instead they used this precise example, because I gather both houses must be involved in the legislation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Under the House language, which is the original language, of course, in both bills, there was a question as to whether this would, in effect, be a conflict of interest. The language in the Senate bill, a gift of travel and hospitality received by a member of the legislature in obtaining information on matters of legislative concern, is not prohibited by this section. Under the Senate version, yours would clearly, that would clearly not be. Under the House version, I think that it would legally not be, but it would be kind of arguable.
So, if I may, so it would be better for us to adopt some kind of language along that line, wouldn't it? I mean, similar to what the Senate has.
It would appear to be.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Does the Senate language specify that when that kind of activity occurs, the members disclose that, in fact, it's in the interest of the state that, or for gathering information?
No, there is no mention of that.
But if it wasn't in the interest of the state, it would not be a conflict, then, would it?
It would not be a conflict. That's the point. They set it up deliberately where it's not a conflict.
However, let's assume now that I'll go back to the same example that I had when I had to go to Fairbanks and go up the highway. Would it have been a conflict of interest for the Teamsters to fly me up in their airplane to Fairbanks? Would have been a conflict of interest also to get in that Linden Transport, because it's the only kind of a vehicle you can go up there to haul me with? Would it have been a conflict of interest to have dinner at the Arco camp up there, and so on? This would all have been a conflict of interest. How else would I have done it? The state would have paid for it, or I would have paid for it personally?
Chairman, yes.
The amusing thing is that under the existing language, the answer would be, yes, it's a conflict on them taking you up. The Linden Transport, I'm not quite sure, but that sounds like a no. The meal would be a no, and the lodging at the lodge would be a yes, so you'd have had two conflicts and two clears
on
your hypothetical, and I might have missed something in your hypothetical.
Coming back, that's also a conflict.
Yeah, but that...
you see, it doesn't allow the legislator, well, then, and just in the case of a legislator, to do the things that are sometimes pretty damn mandatory that we get out and do. All you got to say to your constituents, the heck with it, I can't do that, it's conflict of interest. And they say, well, geez, what are you down here for,
Mr. Chairman? Yes. I mean, to follow up on this, not only the Resource Committee, but to my knowledge, you know, I think Atlantic Richfield and Ohio, pertaining to the resources, have a standing offer for, during the interim, for any legislator that happens to be in Fairbanks or whatever, that they will take them up and give them a tour of their facilities and show them what's going on and how this is done and all that. And to me, I mean, if a person had that kind of time and could go do something like that, that certainly should not fall under a conflict of interest.
But it does, according to this. The other thing, Mr. Barrier, is that I'm finding the more I get into this thing, that I'm finding my wife is a conflict of interest. So I guess I'll have to divorce her.
No, no.
She works for Atlantic Richfield.
Oh, then she...
And she cooks my meals and...
I don't quite think so under any version. If I were answering under the Senate version, the answer to your long hypothetical would have been different. The whole trip would not have been a conflict.
Now then, under the Senate version of it, this all changes, does it not?
Yes.
Thank you. You want to continue?
Yeah.
You've asked him.
Thank you. In relation to Mr. Abood's hypothetical example, for him to declare the whole trip, would he have to list, for instance, the transportation, the two different kinds of transportation separately, or because they're being contributed by different companies?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I would think that probably a single disclosure would be the whole trip under 110.3 would in either instance be an adequate disclosure. I don't think you'd have to file a whole series of disclosures.
I see. Okay, you want to continue on then, sir? Yes.
Is it appropriate to make a suggestion that we adopt language as the Senate on the Senate?
Not at this time. I'd like to hear the total.
Sure.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the next section is nepotism, 2460090, page 6, line 25. Under this, a person who is related to a member of the legislature may not be employed in the same house as the legislator, nor may the relative be employed in either house during the interim. A person who is related to an employee may not be employed at any time in a position in which the employee has supervisory authority. However, there is an out in both of them. An individual is not employed if no compensation is received from the state for the services provided. A typical example is that it's very, very common, for example, for a legislator to use his wife as a secretary or an AA or virtually full time.
Well, he couldn't get her a job over in one of the agencies either, could she? He could, if he wasn't the supervisor. Is that right?
No. Oh, I'm sorry. They may not be employed by an agency of the legislature either.
Over which?
No, Mr. Chairman. Look at line 27 on page 6. A member of the legislature, this is only a relative of an employee. A relative of a member may not be employed by an agency of the legislature in either bill.
Mr. Larson.
Yeah. Mr.
Berry,
my question was, you know the philosophy behind the interim? Because as I read this, say my son and my daughter can work for the Senate while session's on, but then once the session's over, they can no longer work for the other body. Is that just the same? And if so, what's the philosophy behind that?
Chairman, that's what it's saying, and I will try, since it's not my argument, to recast it about as well as possible, rather succinctly. In essence, people from all over the state legislators come down during the session. They usually bring their wife and family, or most often bring their wife and family. Employment opportunities are fairly limited, and there's a question of how many things there are to do during the session. So you have a peculiar situation during the session that they felt would justify this, but they felt it would not justify that these same peculiar facts don't exist during the interim, so that it wouldn't be applicable there.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Let me ask you a question. For example, if my wife is an employee of the Department of Education, and in through various parts of the Department of Education, she has worked for approximately 14 years. Under this,
she would not be allowed to work during the interim between sessions to work because it is an agency of the legislature, basically.
Oh, no, it isn't.
No, no. Okay.
Exactly right.
Okay, good. Good. That means she couldn't work for me.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay.
One more brief question, Mr. Chairman. In your opinion, could this section be defended in court?
Yes.
Both versions?
I think the versions are identical, aren't you, Mr. Chairman?
Well, no, there's some changes, but I don't think there's substantial changes. Wordly. Okay, let us go on then.
2460-100, again, there's very substantial differences between the House and the latest Senate version. It's on page 7, commencing on line 7, representation by legislators. A member of the legislature may not accept as provided in this section represent another person for compensation before an agency board or commission of the state. Under B, a member of the legislature may represent a client in an action before a court of the state, or a matter which was pending at the time the person to whom this chapter applied assumes office or is employed. The heading needs some work there in the House version. And it says you cannot waive the conflict of interest by not accepting compensation in a situation in which compensation would normally be expected.
I'll be back in about 10 minutes.
Okay.
The Senate version takes the opposite attack, the opposite of the two when you get in this area. Really, I tend to think of things as either prohibitory or disclosure. Essentially, the House version is prohibitory. The Senate just simply, if you could otherwise do it, you can go ahead and do it, but you have to disclose it in the journal or to the commission. Those are the net results of the two.
Okay.
2460-110 is action on a conflict of interest. When you have a conflict, a legislator who has a conflict of interest has essentially three choices. He can resign the position or divest the interest that's resulted in the conflict or potential conflict, or as a third alternative, disclose the conflict of interest in the journal. In other words, you have your disclosure requirement, but you can resign or divest the interest if that appears preferable to the disclosure requirements.
Mr. Berry states in the Senate version that a legislator who knowingly has a conflict of interest
or has been notified of a conflict of interest shall immediately do these one of the three things.
Yes.
Well, number one, yeah, and that's if okay, somebody files a complaint against me, and that there's a potential, or there is a conflict of interest. That has not been proven through the commission, the legislature, or anybody. But according to that, that means that I must, upon notification, whether it be true or otherwise, resign my position, or divest my interest, or what? Disclose in the journal of the appropriate body, or to the commission if we're not in session, etc. But, Mr. Chairman, of course, being notified of a conflict of interest, if it's not well-founded, of course, there's no response that you need to take.
That is not stated in this Senate version.
It says a legislator who knowingly has conflict of interest or has been notified of a conflict
of interest. Not an alleged conflict, a conflict. There's a difference between an allegation of a conflict
and this is
a conflict.
After the fact, that after he's been proven he's got a conflict by the commission.
Well, with the disclosure thing, I would think that a legislator, if you had something that was potentially a conflict, would prefer to disclose it. The mandatory requirement wouldn't come in, but the disclosure thing, I would suspect most, if they felt, now, this is a borderline situation, would tend to disclose it.
Have we got so many conflict of interest possibilities that one could go on and not really know he had a conflict of interest?
Yes. You want an example?
Yes.
I didn't mean sound quite the way I sounded there.
That's all right. I accept it.
Let's look back at the loan situation.
This bill, Senate?
In either bill, I think they're virtually identical.
Okay, page and blank.
Let's use the House bill. Page 4, lines 12 to 19, C. The lending agency must send a copy of the application to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I'm not sure that you know whether they've complied with that or not. Then, E. State agents to have authority to grant loans shall adopt regulations that establish separate procedures for granting and reviewing loans for a person to whom this chapter applies. I think you or I could very easily apply for a loan, fill in the application, tell them I work for Legislative Affairs Agency or I'm a member of the House. They give you the form, you fill it in, and you find out that they've never bothered to establish separate procedures. So you can find yourself in either of those two hypotheticals in a conflict situation that you don't know you're in a conflict and you've operated in full good faith.
And you could be fined?
Yes, and that's the point, of course, of this knowingly or has been notified of language.
Okay, let's go on.
Yes. The next is 120, state property or funds. A person to whom this chapter applies may not use state property or funds for private gain or campaign purposes. The Senate version just makes it private gain, leaving out the or campaign purposes. The argument there, if you'd like to hear it, was that it gets kind of difficult to draw a line, and somebody commented that his best campaigning is when he responds to a constituent inquiry in his capacity as a legislator and uses maybe the state telephone to do it. Then
that's a conflict?
Yeah. Is that using the argument, and I think it's far-fetched, but a lot of people felt that this is the kind of thing you could get blown up. You worry about far-fetched situations because of publicity, not because of what would happen in court or before the committee. That someone could allege that your use of the telephone in your office answering constituent inquiries is a use of state property for campaign purposes. I'm sure no committee or court would ever hold that, but...
I'm getting about weary about taking any elected job, including being a legislator with this stage of show. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Wouldn't the most logical defense for that thing would be to say, you know, that's exactly what you're elected to do, to come down here and represent your constituency and the statewide and everything else. But you know, when you do have, you know, you spend a lot of time on telephone, writing letters and things, dealing with your constituents. And to me, that's exactly, if it's not myself down here, that's for damn sure what I want the person that's representing me doing. I want him, if I call him, I want him to respond to me. If I write him a letter, I want him to respond by letter. And that's his job.
Mr. Harrison, yeah. As I say, I have no doubt that it's not, but some people were worried about baseless charges being made, which is essentially the Senate rationale for taking that out.
And frankly, there could be a lot of baseless charges.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Larson?
Under this bill, they aren't baseless charges because this bill states any conflict or alleged conflict, you are guilty.
I know. Let's continue.
Then I'll go back to the House version, because starting with this next thing, you've got an absolutely total divergence between the House and the Senate approach, or the latest Senate approach. The House bill establishes a legislative ethics commission of 7 members, one appointed by the President of the Senate, one appointed by the Speaker, each with concurrence of 3/4 of the full membership of the House. Then you have 2 persons who are public members appointed by the President and Speaker, again with concurrence of, in this case, they dropped it to 2/3 of the House, and the 5th member is a former legislator who is appointed by the other members of the commission. Then C, on page 8, provides no more than 4 members may be members of the same political party or residents of the same borough or the unorganized borough. D provides that they elect officers, except the persons who are members of the legislature may not be the chairman or vice chairman. They set up a 4-year term for the public members, and a legislator may not serve beyond the expiration of the term of office. And they provided a commission member may not serve more than 1 full term.
Question right there, term of office. We're on the House is on 2 years. So that could go on for 4 years, could go on for 6 years if he's allowed, if he runs for election and is elected in for three terms. He could have a 6-year seat. Or no, it would be only 4 years, right? No.
Mr. Chairman.
But the legislative term of office, that doesn't mean if he's only been there for 2 years, he'd have to get off it. Because he's never really out of that term of office. Or is he?
I think there's an ambiguity of language here. I think the concept was that this may not serve more than 1 full term applied to the public members, but I think there's an ambiguity in the language here.
I think it's in the House version. Discriminatory on the House member side, because most of the Senate is on a 4-year term, House side's on a 2-year term. So I think that language there is
but it would be
you're right, they're not all 4-year terms, but it would be the legislator's term of office. The only way that can be meaningful at all is
they're equal terms.
But in context, I think you're right. They are saying the House members can serve only 1 2-year term, where the other people serve 4.
And if he gets reelected, he's automatically off that commission.
Yes.
Whereas the Senate member, assuming they went both one in the same in 80, 82, would be on for 4 years.
As would be the public members.
Yes. This particular section seems to have been rewritten in virtually every version, and there's been a lot of them.
Okay.
Then F provides a member of the commission may not hold or seek elective office, be it office of political party, political committee, or lobby. And G says this does not apply to the legislator members.
Now, again, the member of the commission may not hold or seek an elective office.
Right. That's other than the legislators.
Be an officer of a political party, political committee. I don't think you can get anybody in the legislature other than legislators. All you do now is talking about, all they do is talking about the public members.
The public members, yes.
You'd have trouble filling those positions, it would seem to me. Members of the a Republican Party, a Democratic Party, a Libertarian Party, a committee on it, fundraising committees. God, I can think of a thousand things in there that would affect.
Well, this is just being an officer of the party here.
Okay.
Then H provides that a vacancy shall be filled in the same way the original appointments were filled.
Okay, what does the Senate do then? I mean, are we through with that part? No, no, we're still got a long ways to go. Don't we?
Well, there's just two others, and they're both fairly short.
Okay.
That the commission may contract for professional services, appoint staff, or employ staff, and a member may not serve as staff. And J, they receive no compensation, but they do receive travel expenses and per diem.
But if the legislator is on this commission, and it happens during the time that, during the interim period, and he has no other reason, he can't do it on a committee structure, on a standing committee, to go to this particular meeting, he wouldn't get travel expenses if it would be held someplace else and
Put
him where he lives. In other words, that's just saying you can't get it twice.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't get both paid for. It would be paid for from the legislative per diem, which is different, but you couldn't collect both that and the board and commission per diem.
Okay. Could we then go through the Senate one now?
The Senate version is a totally distinct version. The House version, the commission, is a mixed commission. Under the Senate version, it's set up as a select committee. The select committee consists of six legislators, three from the House, three from the Senate. Then, to make this clear, maybe I will have to skip around a little among sections.
The appointment is the same way they're appointed by the chair, subject to confirmation. As you get further in the authority of the commission, you'll find it in the Senate version. If it's a member of the Senate committee has jurisdiction. If it's a member of the House committee has jurisdiction. If it's a staff member of the House or the Senate, the respective body has. If it's a former legislator or an agency, the full commission has jurisdiction, and the full commission has jurisdiction to issue advisory opinions. That's essentially the Senate Senate composition.
Question: would it not be advisable in that this whole bill is directed toward legislators and staff in particular? Could a member of that commission or two members of that commission be staff? A makeup of the House, the Senate, and staff? What would be your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, speaking as a staff member, I really doubt that would work. The reason is simple. We work for the legislature, so I don't mind you judging my conduct, but when you put it the other way around, I would not like to be judging yours with possibly imposing sanctions.
I may also say that I'm on, let's say I was on there as a House member.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to pass judgment also on the Senate side and the staff member. Why shouldn't that be an equal?
Chairman. You would, as far as agencies, we work for the whole legislature, so as a House member, you would pass judgment on the House members, the House staff, the agencies, and the former members, since in a couple places a former member is prohibited from doing things. But you would not pass on the Senate members or the Senate staff as a House member in the Senate contemplation.
Could we perhaps limit that staff member to a range 18?
It is limited to a range of 18. This doesn't apply to anybody under 18 in either version.
No. The member of the commission be an 18. Can't be a 19 or a 20 or a 21 or a 22 or a 97 like you are, maybe.
Unfortunately not.
I'm just saying to have those people, those staff members, represented by to limit it to, do you see what I'm trying to get at? Here, this all staff is underneath the same restrictions and conflicts and the whole nine yards as legislators. Why wouldn't it not then be just as fair to have two members of that commission made up of staff, not to exceed a range 19 or a range 20, or I'm trying to get the concept to you. What would be your opinion of that?
Maybe I have an old-fashioned hierarchical opinion.
I see.
From a staff perspective, it would bother me.
All right, let's go ahead then. Let's go ahead then on the Senate version.
All right, on the Senate version, yes. Then the House version has duties of the commission. We're on page 10, 1 through 4. If you switch to a totally inside committee composed of and the committee has the power to subpoena witnesses, administer oaths, etc., with the concurrence of the presiding officer of the body. So none of those three would be necessary, and it's a question as to whether, and they deleted this published semiannual summaries. So you left that and they went into to an authority thing, but if you go to the inside commission, this is not really becomes not really necessary.
So by that same reasoning, if I may interrupt a moment, by the same reasoning, would it not be, there'd be much less of a fiscal note attached to this thing, would it not, when it comes to staff, when it comes to many other things, if it was an inside committee?
Mr. Chairman, I always have trouble with fiscal notes, but it would be cheaper.
Okay, so then it would be cheaper to do it that way than it would be, I see. Go ahead, sir.
The next section is a section 2461-50 on an advisory opinions. Essentially what the advisory opinion is that a person who has questions about they want to do this and they want to do the other, and they want to know if this violates a conflict of interest or if it's permissible, or if it's a violation of ethical standards, they can request from the committee or commission, as the case may be, an advisory opinion. Frequently, this advisory opinion is needed rather rapidly. I keep getting asked these questions, and a question that you'll frequently get asked during the interim is, may I take such and such a job, or may I enter into such and such a contract? A long delay, of course, and the thing would become moot. So they provided that if the advisory opinion is not issued within 30 days after the request, the facts of that case do not cause a violation. And it also provides that the opinion issued or considered issued is binding on the commission in any subsequent proceedings unless material facts were omitted or misstated. Obviously, if you give them wrong facts, they can't be bound by it. But alternatively, if you give proper facts to the committee and they say it's all right, they should be bound by that and not later be able to file complaints or have further proceedings against you.
They are virtually the same, the two.
I think they are.
Right. Okay, let's go to complaints.
One other point. The advisory opinion is confidential, but may be made public by the person who requested it. On the complaints section...
Let me get that straight now. In other words, someone filed a complaint against me.
You're not in a complaint situation here. You've asked for an advisory opinion.
Okay. So I've asked for an advisory. It's up to my discretion as to whether or not I want to make it public or not.
Yes. It's kind of like,
I'm the only one that can do it.
Right. It's kind of like the executive session thing. Yeah, okay. If they have an executive session, unless the person requests it be public.
Okay. We'll go on.
Then on the complaint section, I would suggest on that that we...
I'm sorry. That's not complaint section, is it? I think we're in the proceedings before the committee now.
What? I'm sorry.
Proceedings.
Well, it's labeled proceedings. Complaints in the House bill and proceedings right. Before the committee in the Senate bill.
All right.
If I may comment, these are essentially identical, except the complaint section as originally written, because we were working under some very severe time constraints in writing these things with a new one coming out each day. It was written in a series of concept ideas, which makes it very, very difficult to follow. As I wrote an analysis of this, I found I had to break it up and take it all out of order in order to analyze it so it could be read nice, so that it could be followed. other people had this difficulty, and I was requested to write essentially the same thing, except put it in a sequence so that it goes step by step what happens. And so the Senate and the House versions are, practically speaking, except there was one little glitch in the House version when you analyzed it all the way through, or the Legislative Reform Commission version, are essentially identical, except I think this proceedings before the committee, or the commission if you choose to go that route, is a considerably more intelligible and easier to follow section.
Where's that? I'm trying to find
it. On the Senate bill, that starts on line 20, page 9. House bill, it starts on line 28, page 10.
20, page 9. It isn't headed up then, complaints, is it?
No, it's headed proceedings before the committee.
I see. Which is relatively the same thing.
Except this is more accurate because you've got complaints, and then at a certain stage, the complaints go into charges.
Right.
So proceedings is a better term.
Okay.
Under A, you've got the broad general power that the committee may initiate, receive, and consider complaints. B is a statute of limitations. They may investigate a violation within 4 years after the violation, or within 1 year after termination of state service. However, like most statute of limitations, nothing bars proceeding against a person who intentionally prevents discovery of a violation. In other words, you can't cover up and then count on the statute of limitations. C, before they exercise the powers authorized in this section, they shall define the nature and scope of the inquiry by a resolution adopted by a vote of the full membership of the committee. The point is there, you can't go just on a wild-ranging hunt into every activity a person might have done. You've got to define the scope, and it's provided that the investigation is on a confidential basis. Then you get down to the actual proceeding. The proceeding is initiated by the filing of a complaint, which may be by a private person or three members of the committee. It has to be in writing and signed by the complainant. And then there is a provision, no complaint other than a complaint initiated by five or more members of the committee may be received within a period of 60 days preceding a state primary or general election. This is in both. The Senate version added, in effect, a stay that you can't initiate one during that period, and if one is pending, all proceedings in it are stayed during the immediate pre-election period.
Mr. Barrier, in that regard, with the 60-day period, time period before the general and primary election, that leaves about a 9 or 10-day period between the primary election and the 60 days prior to the general.
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. This was thought of in that state thing, and it stayed until the legislature convened, primarily because as you run the time, if you don't do it that way, you do have that 9 or 10 day period. But under the Senate version, no further action may be taken in the state proceeding until the legislature next convenes in regular session. So it avoids that gap.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Furness.
This section, who may initiate this advisory opinion? Mr.
Chairman. The advisory opinion is initiated by request of the person.
The
legislator or staff member, et cetera, et cetera, okay, are the only ones who can request an advisory opinion.
Well, they're the only one that can release it for other person's review?
Mm-hmm. Right. Go ahead, sir. E is fairly normal due process, that you've got to notify the guy in writing of the allegations, and the summary dismissal, that if a complaint does not contain allegations of facts sufficient, if they're treated as true to constitute a violation, the committee may summarily dismiss the complaint. In other words, if you're alleged that you did this, this, and this, and they say, okay, so if that's true, it's not a violation, that's the end of the proceeding. There's no point in going ahead with a long hassle.
F,
the commission shall investigate the charges and issue an advisory opinion to the person alleged to violate a provision of this chapter.
Whether he requests it or not?
If it's a complaint, whether he requested it or not, an advisory opinion is issued.
Is that confidential?
That is confidential.
And can only be released by the
person charged.
By the person charged.
I see, okay.
Let me pursue something here. That report is done and it's confidential. The person who initially filed the complaint in turn seeks, say, criminal action or further court action. I would assume that that report can be subpoenaed by the court, can it?
No.
I would think not. I would have to think it over, but I would think not, because that would be an independent proceeding. And these proceedings are not subject to court review. They were, it was very deliberately kept out of court because the courts hold them properly that at least as legislators, their disciplinary stuff, unless they violate criminal law, is a matter for the legislature to deal with. Then there is another out that was not mentioned, but is obviously clear in context intended in the original version, that if the committee determines there's a probable violation that can be corrected and doesn't warrant any imposition of penalty other than correction, the opinion recommends the advisory action. I mean, recommends the corrective action. In other words, they'll say, we'll divest that or do this or file this form and this, they have to, of course, determine that it's obviously not a serious offense because it would have other sanctions. The person may then comply with the opinion or request a hearing before the committee, in which case he may argue that the advisory opinion has recommended correction action is inappropriate, that there actually is no violation and it isn't necessary. And after the hearing, the commission may amend or affirm the advisory opinion. Then if the person fails to comply, or the commission originally determines that there's a violation which requires more than corrective action, the committee then will formally charge the person. At this stage, you're in a full proceeding basis. The charge and statement shall be personally served on the person charged. Let me use an analogy, if I might. The proceedings up to here are somewhat, and you've got to treat this analogy with caution, are somewhat like a grand jury proceeding. Once you file a charge, it's much like a charge is filed in criminal court. I'm just using that as a procedural illustration, and otherwise it doesn't apply. Then the charge and statement of violation shall be served on the person. Charge, the person has 20 days in writing to respond to the committee. The committee may set a time and place for a hearing with notice to the complaint, if any, and to the person charged with the violation. Then the hearing is a full due process hearing with opportunity to be heard, subpoena witnesses, require production of books and papers to be represented by counsel, have the right of cross-examination with, and testimony under oath. This has some, you're in a proceeding that can have substantial sanctions, so I think it's necessary here that you have a full due process rights in these hearings. Hearings are closed to the public, again, unless the person charged requests an open hearing. The committee is not bound by the formal rules of evidence, but the decision must be based upon competent and substantial evidence. This is the normal administrative body's basis. The testimony shall be taken and evidence maintained, but this testimony and evidence are available only to the committee and its staff and to the person charged.
Now, we're in under trial right now.
You're under what's basically a trial right
trial
now.
Right now.
It's really an administrative hearing, but I find it simpler to think of it in a trial context, although it isn't really.
Right. Let me ask another question.
Yeah.
Is there any sanction for an individual who wrongfully or intentionally or willfully accuses a legislator of conflict of interest?
Mr. Chairman, no, there isn't, and I rather seriously doubt that you could impose it. There is a summary dismissal. By the way, you find the same thing in the court system. All kind of wild charges filed and summarily dismissed to get people in the court system.
This could be a very busy committee, could it not?
It could be.
You don't vote on somebody's bill and he decides, by golly, I'm really going to throw some smoke up like we get all the time anyway. So You know, maybe a difference in maybe some philosophical differences. Says I'm just going to turn them in, I guess. Here we go. Mr. Vest.
Yeah, I agree, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I think in some instances, because you're a public official, at times you're subject to public criticism, which may be falsely, you may be falsely accused. And not just once, but consistently over a period of time. And that can be done by a private individual by simply taking an ad out in the newspaper, which can be very misleading, but because you are a public official, he is allowed to do that in that context.
But, Mr. Chairman, this doesn't really differ an awful lot from the situation in court. There reaches a stage that you can sue for abuse of process. It's fairly difficult. A couple of examples. A complaint in court was filed that J. Curtula did various things, like not preventing the adoption of the Federal Reserve Act. Of course, he wasn't born at the time, I understand. And I got accused, incidentally correctly in another case, of being one of the prime authors of the City and Borough Juneau Charter. I mean, and they go into court and just get dismissed out. I don't know a way you can get around these.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what comes to mind is Terry Miller's problem with if it was ever a problem with the National Guard, that an individual from Anchorage, Eagle River, keeps taking advertisements in the newspaper out, which are totally false, and that he does that whenever Terry Miller does something. And there's no way to stop that.
No. Well, you couldn't stop it anyway, because you can't do anything 60 days prior to a primary or a general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so that would go on anyway.
That's the only thing you can do is that time limit, you know.
Yeah, but he couldn't bring you to court on it anyway. See, he could afterwards, maybe. Mm-hmm. But then again, if that be the case, you'd have to resign your position or do something. You see, we're getting ourselves into a tremendous box on this thing, where I don't think anybody wants to go through that particular harassment. If a guy says, fine, I'll resign. I don't like this baloney. You have to come in here and be falsely accused of this stuff.
But, Mr. Chairman, that's why you got this summary dismissal. And the false accusations, at a certain stage you can violate it, but under Times versus Sullivan, you know the problem. I don't think you can get around unless you get to very, very extreme cases, and then you can sue, and then it doesn't do much good.
So then in the case of, if I may interrupt just one moment, in the case of, let's say that I don't like to bring up the names, but the senator, the member in the other body regarding some island, that would have never gone to court, would it? It would have been handled right here, wouldn't it? If this were thing were in place, wouldn't have had to go to court.
Not the island, then.
Well, the
camp.
The camp.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chairman, that would have made no difference. It could have been handled here, and it could now, with or without this. Don't forget, the legislature has plenary power to discipline its own members. The legislature right now, with nothing on the books,
can still do
this. Not the legislature, each house can still do this. And if this were in effect, this would not prevent any criminal prosecution that could be brought otherwise.
I see. Okay, continue on, please.
By the way, the last provision in the section F is, if the person charged with violation requests a copy of the transcript, the copy shall be furnished by the committee without charge. Transcript costs can get very, very expensive. Then the decision the committee is in writing and signed by a majority of the members of the committee. And each decision is accompanied by a written order determining whether a violation exists or not exists, and the order is confined to this. This order is a public record. Then if
I understand, I understand why the Senate wants it to be an in-house deal more than an outside area. The guy could make a living on this and an occupation out of this committee, at least 4 years.
Mr. Chairman, if you're making a living on your per diem, I go through right above and tell the rest of us how to do it.
I've got it half started. Go ahead.
I'm anxious to see the last chapter.
Then you've been meeting all the time.
No, you can't be from Juneau to make a living.
Then you come in effect, Mr. Chairman, to what, again using the trial analogy, is called the penalty phase of the trial. If the commission decision finds a member of the legislature has violated the provision of this chapter or has declined or failed to cooperate, it shall refer the decision to the presiding officer of the legislature. The decision contains a statement of the facts determined to constitute the violation or the failure to cooperate and may contain recommendations concerning any penalties the legislature may lawfully impose. The House version had a long laundry list of possible penalties. The Senate deleted this laundry list on the, or the Senate Judiciary deleted this laundry list, the thinking being that a laundry list actually confines your options rather than elaborates on them. In other words, if you've got A, B, C, D, E, and it turns out you want to do F, and you would be authorized otherwise, they're going to say no, but they just meant you could do these or things that are very similar. So laundry lists tend to be confining.
Well, in this area here, it shall refer the decision to the presiding officers of the legislature.
Yes.
Presiding officers being the speaker and the president.
The speaker and the president.
Now then, they've got that in front of them.
And then they
come up with any penalties.
No.
They don't.
No. And this was very deliberately left open in all versions. And incidentally, you'll notice that there's 30 days between making a decision public after the referral and the time it's submitted. What's been found from experience is that actually setting up the procedures in-house for a body to discipline its members gets to be very complex, and the in-house procedures might very well vary depending on the seriousness of the violation. The only time this has been used, there was a very, very formal in-house proceedings with very full due process rights. The seriousness of the accusations made that necessary. That took a while to set up. On the other hand, if it's a violation, but a relatively not awfully important one, they may just want to use, assign it to Rules Committee or Judiciary Committee for a recommendation to the body. So the procedure is that what procedures the body would actually take with these were not set out, but in effect the body is given 30 days. Then at the end of the 30 days, the decisions are made public.
Okay, now, if the committee decides issues a decision,
yes,
then the violation has been violated, the sign has been violated. Then it shall refer, the committee refers the decision to the presiding officer.
Right.
Presiding officers now have, and in it the decision, that refers the decision to them. Now these two, when they put it out, shall contain a statement of facts determined to constitute the violation.
No.
Now, wait, I'm reading it.
No, the decision contains that.
This doesn't
tell the presiding officers at all what they have to do.
No, they've got the violation in front of them with all the facts.
Yeah.
Okay. The committee now
has
the facts
and the recommendations.
Right. So then it turns it over to the two presiding officers.
Right.
Shall refer the decision. So evidently the decision has been made by the committee, right?
Yes, the committee has issued.
They've made the decision.
They made the committee decision.
And now they're turning the decision over to the two presiding officers.
Well, specifically
right?
To a presiding officer.
It says, here you're dealing with a member of the legislature. So
okay.
What you would do, let's say it was Senator, you would give that decision to the President of the Senate and so on. Okay.
Yeah.
Now then,
that decision shall contain a statement of facts determined to constitute the violation of failure to cooperate and may contain recommendations concerning the penalties the legislature, being again the Senate, will say,
yeah,
may lawfully impose, the full House of the Senate.
Yes.
To impose. Then that goes back to the committee, and they make the decision public in
no.
30 days?
No. Then it's before the body. At this stage, there's no practical way to compel the legislature to act. There's not even a legal way to compel the legislature to act. But the committee, of course, has kept the decision. The legislature has 30 days. Then at the end of the 30 days, the decision is made public. That's the end of the commission involvement. But any time the commission has determined that a violation has occurred, that will be made public, the decision, the facts, the whole thing.
Hmm.
In other words, you've got a disclosure sanction at any event, which would be some incentive for the body itself to act in. Because if you get a disclosure and there's been no comment, the body's acted.
But that isn't the final decision either, is it?
That's the final decision under this.
Well, then what have we got? The employee is entitled to a hearing before final action.
No, here it's split between employees and legislators for very obvious reasons. We're talking at the moment only about legislators.
Then you come to the decision of an employee.
The committee issues a public statement 30 days after the date of the decision.
So he's got 30 days he can appeal.
So he's got, the employee has 30 days.
Okay.
Again, the legislature shall act on the decision as it considers appropriate. In the case of an employee, the action may include suspension, demotion, or dismissal, and the employee is entitled to a hearing before final action is taken. The reason this was put in, again, this is a laundry list thing this may include, but there's been a feeling we've had at least one very, very major case in the amount of money, time, and effort spent on the question of firing an employee. So in an excess of caution, it was felt that there should be a specific authorization in this instance.
Sure. Since we put this out, I've had some thoughts about the 30 days, and I was wondering what Bill's reaction to that. The more I think about it,
by announcing the decision you've made, and announcing the decision, but not any of the backup which relates to the decision, it seems to me what we're doing is fanning the flames of rumors that
people assume
the situation is 10 times worse than might very well be in there. And what I can't really tell you what our rationale was for the 30 days other than just to give the House time to act or something like that. But it seems to me if we made the decision public immediately.
The House still has as much time to act as it wants to take anyway, or even not act. So what was our rationale for the 30 days?
The rationale was essentially the order just determines a violation exists or does not exist.
Yes.
Then the facts, the and particularly the recommendations, penalties, and so forth, were to be kept confidential so that you would have a time period without that much public pressure.
But I think that's where we're making mistakes. I think we're probably going to get more public pressure because everybody's going to be dying to know what all the facts is. Well, let me ask you this. Do you see any harm if we didn't have the 30 days? If we had gave each presiding officer a decent amount of time, like 24, 36 hours, like in case it was over the weekend, to kind of call leadership together and do what they decided they needed to do, but not make it 30 days?
I think, Mr. Chairman.
Well, yes.
I think that's a pure policy thing. There is some decided advantage in giving the legislature, and you know the thing that gave rise to this need and the difficulty in setting up a disciplinary process. That was fairly traumatic.
But in both cases, and in K and
I think it's a pure policy matter.
Or in K and L, we're still talking about a definite violation has been committed.
They have determined that a violation has been committed.
So therefore, I think that 30 days, they should put something out if a violation has been there. I mean, that would be my personal opinion. Because if it's wrong, by golly, it's wrong. Yeah. And therefore, it should be made. I mean, 30 days seems to cover it as far as I would be concerned.
Certainly
a
policy.
Take some kind of action instead of just sitting there and waiting. And
well,
that would be my rationale.
Even with 30 days, there's no assurance any action is going to take place. That's why my thing is we just have to make all this public immediately by keeping part of it confidential. Plus, you have the added problem is that everybody knows around here as soon as it lands on the speaker of the president's desk. Somebody's got to start talking about it to make a decision, so it can't stay confidential anyway.
As I say, I think that's
a
very pure policy.
Yeah.
You can make a quite decent policy argument either way.
Yeah. I think so.
I can't have additional questions.
No.
Then M is the confidentiality provision that a committee member or a member of the committee staff who divulges information concerning a proceeding except permitted in this chapter is guilty of Class A misdemeanor. The Class A misdemeanor is misuse of confidential information. And
what are the penalties there? What do we have? 30 days, 5?
I think it's a fine and a punishment of up to 1 year imprisonment. It's, but this is the same as any other disclosure of confidential information under the criminal law.
It's been a question about that. Yeah.
Okay. Should I continue, Mr. Chairman, with the point on the again, the change that was made by the, on the Senate side in this area?
I'd say, yeah.
They added a section requiring state agencies, to the extent permitted by state or federal law, to cooperate fully with the committee or commission by providing information and assistance when they're investigating a probable violation. And then the Senate added a definition clause, person employed by a member of the legislature. In other words, there was a feeling that, let me give the example that brought out Senate Judiciary. Suppose I have my legislative staff, but I also own a Frito-Lay outfit. Are the people that work in my Frito-Lay franchise employed by a member of the legislature? So there was a definition of, I think not pretty clearly, but people were bothered. So there's a definition. They thought a person acting in a legislative capacity might do, staff doesn't act in a legislative capacity, so that's why the definition is here. And I think that pretty well covers the thing, and I think I essentially...
Mr. Furness?
We may want to just go back for the benefit of the hearing and have Mr. Cowdery on the M. You mentioned a committee member, a member of the committee staff who divulged information concerning a proceeding except as permitted by the chapter. Guilty of a Class A misdemeanor, and that's either a fine or perhaps up to 1 year punishment or whatever.
Well, that's the question I wanted to ask. Suppose a committee member, being a legislator, is found guilty of this as a Class A misdemeanor. Now you got one on. Now you got a committee member that's got to resign from the House, right, or the Senate case may be.
Class A misdemeanor?
Yes, Chairman.
With a legislator, this gets a little touchy when you're prosecuting for a misdemeanor. You can definitely commit a misdemeanor. That is not a violation of this chapter. What you've done there is, in effect, violate criminal law, and it's like any other misdemeanor. You, of course, have your legislative immunity, which means that you can, and this is either a felony nor a breach of the peace, so as a legislator, you can assert your constitutional immunity and not be prosecuted until the end of the session.
Yes, but after the session, then
after
they can
the
hold
session.
That over you, and then they got you. For instance, loose lips sink ships and everything. All it says is committee member or staff who divulges information, even talks about it, he can get it, and somebody mails them. Okay, well,
that's the only way you can enforce this, to have some kind of
We ought to put that in our coalition, for you and me.
Loose lips.
I guess that wasn't very funny.
Okay, are there any further questions from Mr. Barrier?
Barrier, thank you very much for your taking the time out of your sickness and all that to give us this.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I would entertain, and I would like to I have a note there. He's also relieved from the committee if he does that too, I presume. Relieved of his duty to the committee.
Maybe
the regulations of the committee itself and steps that are rules by the committee. It just seemed to me that in going over both of these bills, that the Senate version has more substance to it than the House one. I would move we adopt the language in the committee substitute for Senate Bill 257, Judiciary, into House Bill 362 in its entirety.
Object.
There is an objection, Mr. Miller.
Chairman, I make that motion.
Sir?
Yes, that's fine.
I vote, Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the committee, make the motion for the matter for a matter of discussion that we adopt the Senate language in place of the House language.
There is an objection, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, in particular, the makeup of the commission. If you want the public to perceive that this commission has any credibility at all, you can't have it made up entirely of members of the club. If you don't have some public members on there, the public is not going to feel that they have an honest shot at this. So, I suppose I would not have great objection if you had two separate commissions. I don't think it would be sufficient. One for the House, one for the Senate. Both of which had some public members in it. But if you don't have some, and I've come to this conclusion the hard way, Mr. Speaker, I didn't used to feel this way.
But the more I thought about it, I'm just convinced that we're dealing as much in perceptions as anything else, and the public is not going to perceive that this commission is worth the dollars they spend on per diem if it's just an in-house
club decision, among people in the, one old boy to another. If the public is not represented in there, as they are represented in the commission, as it's made up under the joint committee's language, we're going to be passing some really bad legislation.
Chairman?
Mr.
Cotty. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if the decision is made through this committee that there is a violation, the public will have a chance to address that violation in the due process. So it seems to me that maybe some distrust to some of elected officials, but I think of the majority that the people that elect us is a sign of trust by just the mere of election. So
I would tend to agree, and I would also tend to think that the first thing we ought to do is clean our, if we're not, as you said, the public has put the trust in us, therefore it's incumbent upon us to fleece that trust among ourselves. That would be my feeling on it. Let me think of my thought here again. There is enough in this right here, restrictions on what one can do and what can't do as a legislator or an aide, to be able to pin these things right on down. And it would appear to me that that's our responsibility. The legislator's responsibility is made for us. We should be doing it. It should be coming to the full body.
It should be our personal responsibility as elected officials of the people who put the trust in us in the first place, if it would appear to me.
Mr. Schultz.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it was just a question that I was going to raise. What it seems to me as though that in reading over and looking at the language in the 24-61-30 and then compared to that of the Senate version, that it would be a much cleaner operation if we did just have one body rather than the two bodies more or less placing their own rights. And I was just a question, I'm just throwing this out, wondering if we could incorporate the House language. Because there's a lot of these people now, and I was talking with one of the people who's gone to a lot of work on this, Mr. Phillips, and he is very adamant on the not changing that language that's in the, well, not necessarily the changing the language, but ensuring that it is a one body rather than going with the two as the Senate version goes.
Mr. Larson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the United States Constitution provides, of course, for impeachment to the President, Vice President, and all civil officers, and then it goes on to say that each House of Congress should judge its own members. And if that's what we really had within this proposed piece of legislation, I think we should go along with that philosophy. However, within our piece of legislation here, we're still talking about a conflict of interest or an alleged conflict of interest.
And having just members of one house or the other sitting on the commission, that in itself could be alleged to be a conflict, and therefore probably they could never meet if someone made that point. So I guess what I'm saying is I agree with you in philosophy, but I think within the context of a bill that we have before us, it is impossible to do.
So you're saying?
If someone brings up a point saying all representatives, that's an alleged conflict, they cannot hear this case.
I must have missed something.
Well, within this bill it says you're guilty, not only because of the fact, but just because someone alleges that you may be.
That's right.
And if somebody alleges then that there's a conflict of only having representatives serving on the commission, then according to this bill, they must be guilty of a conflict, and in my opinion, therefore, they could not serve as the commission. to hear any case.
Mr. Carter?
I was wondering if Mr. Barrier has any comment on that.
Mr. Barrier, would you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I don't agree with Mr. Larson's analysis.
Thank you. I had hoped that I would be wrong on that.
I think it's fairly clear, and there's a good deal of precedent for having inside ethics commission. I hate to use Congress because they get peculiar compared to the state level, but there's a House Ethics Committee and a Senate Select Ethics Committee, and again, you have much the same thing. You aren't guilty when you have an alleged conflict. You're guilty only when it's been determined that a conflict does exist.
That isn't what this says.
Mr. Carter.
Yes, and I think if you disagree, just that we had, two bills here, and we're going to make one bill, and I think in that very same thing, if we're going to have one body that's going to make some decisions, I think it would be less chance when both bodies...
By having both bodies making decisions, one decision, then have, for having any influence from either body. Crossing over, I think that there's awful strong forces in each body that does have influence. If we had that, we wouldn't have as good of justice as possibly that both bodies make up the...